today on Against the Grain. You may have heard descriptions of socialism or of socialist society, but what would a socialist technology look like? What ends would such a technology serve? And who would decide which products and devices are deployed? I'm CS. Victor Wallace joins me to discuss his new book, Red Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What's happened to technology under capitalism? According to Victor Wallace, hazardous and unsustainable technologies have proliferated as capitalists adapt production to market demand rather than basic human needs. In Victor's new book, Red Green Revolution, he, among other things, sketches the contours of what he calls an authentically socialist technology. He describes what such a technology might achieve and how it might function. Developing socialist technologies, he contends, can't be done without grasping the social and class issues that underlie technological and ecological policymaking in the current moment. Victor Wallace is a professor of liberal arts at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, and for 20 years he was the managing editor of the journal Socialism and Democracy. His new book is Red Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. When Victor joined me recently in studio, I asked him how he would define socialism.
Well, the way I define socialism includes the basic idea of doing away with the class difference that separates the large property owners from the rest of the population under capitalism. And I stress that because in the way that socialism has been defined, for example, by Bernie Sanders, it comes out as being a kind of reapplication of the New Deal and not at all anti-capitalist. My sense of socialism is that it's definitely a rejection and an overturning of the order given to us by capitalism. That's the basic thing. And then to me, the democratic part is integral to that. So I really don't see it as being necessary to add the prefix democratic, although it has become politically necessary for people in order to distinguish what they're aspiring to from the kind of regime that they had in the Soviet Union. But I think that socialism in itself, the idea of social control, the term itself implies a collective control, and a collective control is one that's democratic, otherwise it's not collective.
You begin one of the chapters of your book with this statement: it's time for socialists to reclaim the concept of progress. How has progress come to be understood in capitalist society?
Well, for the capitalists, progress is what they're all about, and they're making it all the time. But for many people, including social critics, but also artists and others, for a long time, I mean, certainly since the mid-19th century, progress has also signified a kind of degradation, because the advances in technology and in production have brought with them a decline in the quality of life, an increase of pollution, and a sort of kind of a speeding up of existence, an alienation of people from one another and from the natural world. So that's why progress has taken on a negative connotation. And in my book, I put that kind of progress in quotation marks because I want to preserve a notion of real progress as being possible, because I think the term itself does imply improvement. And we do need improvement, but in different directions from those that have become customary under capitalism.
And progress often goes along with the term technology, and technology is in the title of your book, Red Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. Technology is, in some people's opinions, neutral. It can be used in ways that, you know, might have good effects on society or bad effects. Is this belief in the neutrality of technology, is that justified in your opinion?
Well, it's a complex issue, but I do take issue with that version of a strict neutrality of technology. I mean, you can say that certain types of devices are neutral, But I define technology in a broader sense as including the whole way in which a device is used. So something like an automobile, you say, well, it can be used for good or bad purposes, but the whole conception of having a vehicle of that scope and power in the hands of every adult resident is negative in my view. And so the technology itself implies its diffusion in the whole adult population, which has adverse effects that I think by now are quite well known in terms of not only greenhouse gases, but of congestion, accidents, road rage, police interference with people's freedom of movement, all kinds of negative things that are associated with the technology of the automobile as understood in its complete application.
Is technology under capitalism? Is technology developed by capital? Is that automatically what you would call a capitalist technology?
Well, I would say that there are many particular devices and many particular techniques that have been developed under capitalism that do have a permanent usefulness. So they certainly do develop useful things. And let's say, for example, also in medical technology, there have been some tremendous advances that have been made within the framework of capitalism. But so what I'm criticizing is the total orientation to technology as providing the solution to all the problems. So in the case of medical technology, I point out that it would be much better if the high-tech procedures did not have to be used nearly as widely, and if instead you could have a system in which people had clean air, clean water, healthy food, and decent working lives and enough relaxation. That's the real precondition for health, and the high-tech interventions, surgical intervention, that kind of thing, should only be in extreme cases, which would not be as often. And this whole critique relates to the idea of innovation, which I talk about also in the book, that there's such a fetish, you might say, about innovation in capitalist ideology. All innovation is creative and good, and that's what I take issue with. And I say that the innovation, the development of higher tech devices that develop a new market is not necessarily a good thing. It may typically be a bad thing because it requires higher inputs of energy and materials and unnecessary use of resources, where positive innovation and innovation and progress in a way interrelated in this sense, where positive innovation is needed and must occur, can occur, is in rethinking the use that's made of particular devices. And so I argue in the book that there are many devices that one must continue to use. So that, for example, in the case of bicycle, which is certainly a technology of transport that we would want to preserve, in order for it to be effective as a full technology and not just as an isolated device, there have to be safe routes. There has to be less distance necessary to cover for people's daily requirements. And various conditions of that nature. And the innovation here consists in designing the communities, say reshaping the communities in such a way that the technology which already exists can be used in the best way possible.
What you seem to be suggesting is that a socialist technology would bring with it a more holistic sense of what, let's say, a particular device does and can do, that somehow the relationships, the network of relations, I think you mentioned in your book, has to be taken into account when developing and using technology.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And can you elaborate on that?
Well, I would come back to the transportation model because that also brings into question the whole question of the layout of human settlements. And so the network of relations here would include how you situate, how you locate geographically or in spatial terms, different workplaces, production units, services, in relation to residences, in relation to natural land, in relation to farmland. So that's the part of the network of relations, which includes also, of course, the whole notion of biodiversity, because the relations are not just among people, or not just between people and space, but between people and other species, and between the various other species among themselves as well. And this is something that's largely overlooked in capitalist agriculture, where the whole emphasis is on vast specialized plantations and chemicals to replace the natural balance that might have existed between pests and predators, the predators who can, that consume the pests. So the network of relations is an all-encompassing thing that really is, that's where you get the holistic idea that you mentioned, that it involves multiple species as well as the relationship of humanity to it, the space in which it lives.
And what prevents technology under capitalism from addressing things in a holistic way and taking all these factors into account?
Well, the drive for profit means that you have to always be looking for new markets, new things to sell, new gimmicks. You have to create needs artificially. For example, the perpetual replacement of one model of iPhone by another, it's not because of any real need. It's just an excuse to make people discard the old one. And we saw this earlier, generation or two ago, with the changes in models of cars, that there'd be some superficial change in the appearance of the car or even the fashion industry, where it's not that that what you develop new is better than the old one. It's just that it's different and that it's become fashionable and that one has to be up to date. So this is a kind of pressure that has nothing to do with whether or not the change serves anyone's need. It's just a change that's valued and rewarded monetarily for its own sake.
Victor Wallace joins me in studio. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Victor teaches at the Berklee College of Music. He was for two decades the managing editor of the journal Socialism and Democracy, and we are talking about his new book. It's called Red-Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism, recently out from Political Animal Press. Now, in your book, you examine, among other things, what the Soviet experience has done to the left's willingness to address and confront the issue of technology. And I want to spend some time on this because to the extent that many people on the left are influenced by the Soviet experience, or at least what they view to be the Soviet experience in relation to technology, that may hold the left back or propel it forward. So how did the early USSR, how did it think about progress and about the project of formulating a socialist conception of progress?
Well, the conception of progress that they held was all the time, I think, still influenced by the capitalist conception, because they did think in terms of building faster and grander and more complete examples of any kind of production. I mean, where you got the most extreme expression of this was in Trotsky's book, Literature and Revolution, where he mentions this notion of people's palaces on the top of Mont Blanc at the bottom of the ocean, the incredible technological breakthroughs. It's very much in the spirit of growth-oriented types of things that is that represents the mentality instilled by capital. So they were, in an overall sense, at that level, trying to compete with capital on its own terms, to overtake it. And this was partly dictated by the need to build up their military and be in a position to defend themselves against the assault they expected. But at the same time, side by side with this, there was a more ecological vision. And this has been written about recently in the Monthly Review. There's an article recently by John Bellamy Foster about this. And Lenin had the idea of promoting these vast nature reserves of areas that would be completely untouched. And they were looking at it largely from the standpoint of scientific research. But obviously, any kind of research that would be done with that assumption would be of a nature to encourage recognition of the importance of the species interrelationships existing in nature. So it was progressive in that sense. That experiment was terminated under Stalin, unfortunately. So in general, then, the technology idea was not that different from what you had under capitalism. in terms of what they saw as constituting progress. The other aspect of the Soviet experience that has to be taken into account and that I discuss somewhat in my book is the whole experience of planning, because part of my understanding is that in order to bring about an ecological conversion, this is something that if we're going to get away from the profit-driven dynamic, we have to do planning, but the planning has to be democratic, and it was not so in the Soviet Union. And this is something that's desired not only because democracy is a more agreeable way of doing things, but also in the more practical sense that if you don't have full communication, full disclosure, full public discussion, you will make errors of a kind that could be avoided. Because if you don't have a democratic system of planning, then the planning that you do have will involve guessing games in which a central agency sets targets and then the different enterprises will try and understate what they're capable of producing so that they'll have no trouble meeting the target. And then the state anticipates that, so they set it higher. And this kind of guessing game, which has nothing to do with the real possibilities of what can be done and doesn't take into account the necessity for coordination between different enterprises in different sectors of the economy, all these things require the fullest possible debate and discussion, and therefore the structures that are inherent in any kind of full democracy. And of course, here by full democracy, this is elaborating on the initial definition of socialism, by full democracy, we mean democracy introduced into every dimension of life, not just a matter of going occasionally to the voting booth, but a participant process which engages everybody both in their workplaces and in their neighborhoods and in the larger community. And that type of thing is something that we haven't developed yet. We haven't talked enough about how it can happen. We haven't recognized what's necessary even to develop the kind of movement we need, which would have a shape that prefigures or that anticipates what we would hope to see in the larger society. And one of the big problems that people often raise is, well, who wants to spend all their time in meetings? We just as soon leave things to be decided by the experts. And as long as we have the right experts in charge, they'll do the right thing. But it doesn't work out that way. The point is to make it clear to people that if they want things to turn out the way they need them to turn out, they have to be part of the process of defining what's going to happen. And in order for that to happen, they have to be incentivized in a way to participate in the discussion in ways that are fruitful. They have to be, for example, paid for the time that they spend it. It can be part of their work time that they spend in the discussions of what their enterprise does. They have to have the necessary education, universal education, so that you don't have just a narrow stratum of experts and everyone else sort of speculating in ignorance. They have to have the adequate media information, and they have to have the adequate structures to encourage them to participate, which means sensitivity to the needs of different people to enable them to participate, taking into account the conditions that they come from.
So I take it you would not, or you are not, comfortable with the degree of deference that ordinary, quote, ordinary people give to experts, people with specialized knowledge on technological or technical issues?
That's right, yeah. I mean, I think there's a big division, which in a way is even increasing, because as you get more and more highly refined technologies, the expertise becomes harder and harder to attain for the average person. And the reaction frequently is to, on the one hand, admire and want the results of this research, but on the other hand, to have a kind of negative attitude towards people who are viewed as intellectuals or experts and so on.
And what do you think experts ought to do as part of their practice, the way they conduct themselves, the way they use their knowledge, use their expertise? What do you think they need to do in relation to ordinary people and popular struggles?
Well, above all, they need to be accountable, and so there has to be machinery for enabling them to become accountable. They have to interact, they have to present their positions and what they're working for in ways that are comprehensible to ordinary people. And the choices ultimately have to be made by the society as a whole. And I would say there's a cultural issue involved here, too, that it's not just a matter of them teaching the ordinary people, but them also learning from the ordinary people. I mean, I hate to use that term, but it's what's in people's conceptions. The experts have to know what people really need, and they can only do that by interacting with the people in question. So there has to be a kind of ease of exchange. And I think that's one of the benefits that comes from doing away with social classes and doing away with the whole sense of competitive rivalries and advantages of one sector over another, and the envies and negative sentiments that arise in that context, that people of every level of expertise or education need to feel that what they have in common is more important than what separates them, and that they can have fruitful exchanges, so that you have people learning about agriculture from peasant practitioners and applying what has become kind of traditional knowledge handed down over a long period of time, incorporated into their what you could call educated synthesis of what's necessary to be done. So definitely breaking down the cultural barriers between what are now separate classes of people, so that distinction is no longer a factor. It's no longer gets in the way of their communication.
Yeah, you write about short courses that might be offered to people, free universities where experts share their skills and knowledge with others.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I think there have been those kinds of things, but only on a limited scale. All these things have been tried, but they need to be expanded, extended, amplified over the whole of the society. The overarching thing that drives my discussion is the extreme urgency of the situation in which all this has to be done. So ideas that have only been practiced to a limited extent really now have to be amplified as a matter of urgency.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Victor Wallace joins me, Wallis. His new book is Red-Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. If, as you say, socialist technology must be democratically controlled, there must be, and I'm quoting from your book, a society-wide decision-making practice in matters of technology, then much of this deliberation, and you've referred to this, is or must be about needs. What are basic human needs and how to meet them with technology that might already exist or might need to be developed? What has happened quantitatively to the levels of basic human needs generated in recent years because of various developments?
Well, under the capitalist regime, there's an infinite expansion of material needs, an infinite expansion of the conception of what you need in order to be satisfied. So if you can have more of something, that's better. Or if you can have a higher grade, say a bigger screen or a more powerful automobile. All these are manifestations of this kind of distorted conception of need, which gets away from the original basic emotional needs that people have, which is the basic needs for sociality, for a kind of harmony among people. Not to say that there'd be no conflicts, but to say that there's not the extreme levels of distrust and suspicion and hostility and racial antagonisms stoked all the time, even by people in high places for their own purposes. So the greatest need is for people to live in peace and harmony. And the point is that a need that you can actually take as the basis for making decisions about policy has to be one that is, on the one hand, universal, and on the other hand, can be satisfied for everyone without depriving anyone else of something. So this is the discourse about needs that I think we have to keep in mind. We have to get away from a definition of needs that makes one think, well, for example, that one needs to be able to attend a competition of who can drive the fastest, the car races. I mean, car races are an example of a totally useless and destructive recreational, supposedly, activity, which there would have to be a kind of general understanding of the idea that this has to be terminated. This doesn't do anything positive. And the people who have come to think that they need it, this kind of drive has to be criticized in a way that puts it in the context of all the costs that arise from the society in which it seems to be natural.
And you're talking about, for example, in the case of car racing, all the pollution generated by all these cars, these automobiles going around in circles.
Exactly. And the extraordinary amount of consumption of fossil fuels and greenhouse gases and materials and the technological stuff that goes into it. I mean, it's all to a kind of useless purpose. It's like the old idea of digging holes and filling them back up again. You go driving round and round and round. I mean, it's insane in a way if you come to think of it. And it's not that that's the most harmful thing, but it's one of the most transparently absurd things that that one has to recognize. And I was a bit close to this because I did live in Indianapolis for 24 years, and that's one of the big cultural foci of that city. Of course, much more severe and more extensive is the whole military apparatus, which includes not only the waging of war, but also the buildup of all the material for that. But I mean, in economic terms, under capitalism, that's counted as a need. It's a need only in terms of the interests of a certain sector of the society, in terms of capitalist domination of the opportunities for resource extraction and control of markets and so on.
Victor Wallace teaches at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, and his new book is Red Green Revolution. We'll take a short break and speak more with Victor about his very interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Victor Wallace joins me in studio. He is a professor of liberal arts at the Berklee College of Music. He has been writing on ecological issues since the early 1990s. His writings have appeared in journals such as Monthly Review and New Political Science, as well as Socialism and Democracy, and he's author of a new book. It's called Red Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. So, yeah, you argue for curbing or scrapping many activities that you find to be wasteful in terms of resources and in terms of just, you know, they don't match or they don't satisfy basic human needs. A lot of people would say, well, we can keep those activities. We just need to use renewable energy sources to power those activities. You know, if we turn to greener methods, then, you know, why deprive people of the freedom of going to watch a stock car race, for example? What do you think of this argument that, you know, let's just get further into and deeper into renewable energy and that will solve a lot of our problems?
Well, the first thing that fails to take into account is the sheer amount of materials and spaces. I'm talking about the example of cars. When people say, well, let's just have cars powered by solar radiation, you still have the enormous amount of materials. You still have all the pavement, the parking lots, and the garages, and this space taken away from nature and agriculture. You still have the social effects associated with that, and the tremendous costs and the energy intensity of the production of all that, which has to be taken into account. The other thing about that is that we are talking about a kind of cultural transformation, because eco-socialism, the image presented by those who say, well, we just need to change the energy and then we can do all the same things, is that we can get an ecologically sound society within the framework of capitalism. And that's what is not possible, in the sense that if we don't change people's orientation towards acquisition and competition, many other negative consequences will follow as well. So all the consequences in terms of military activity will continue. Some of these devices involve extraction of minerals from distant places, say from the United States, where the urge to control the supply entails eventually an interest in determining what kind of regime they have, what kind of intervention there will be. So it won't take you away from having the whole military sector that's one of the biggest obstacles to creating a harmonious and just society. I mean, we have to remember that there's not just the eco part, but the socialist part, and the two are interdependent. That in order to have an ecologically sound society, you do have to get away from the striving for perpetual expansion. And merely changing the energy form that's used for an activity doesn't get away from the drive to expand. And also, since it means that the same class, the same social class of people will continue to be in power, they're not going to put a stop to the continuation of the more obviously destructive forms of energy generation. So that in order to get away from fracking and oil drilling and so on, you need to get away from the class that promotes that. The other thing is, in terms of the exercise of power in the society, if you do have progressive measures enacted at the level of government, like to control pollution and to institute social services like public health care and that type of thing, if you don't change the class that's exercising power, there will always be a pressure to undo those progressive measures that are taken. And so you see, even in countries that have more advanced social systems than the United States, like at the present time Sweden, they build up right-wing forces that would be ready to cut into that because it is not advantageous to the class interests of capital. So in other words, the class antagonism persists, and it's not enough just to change forms of energy.
You also write that renewable energy sources are not without their problematic aspects, are not without their drawbacks.
Yeah, it's not. Sometimes it's drawbacks and sometimes it's just limitations. But I mean, one of the drawbacks one thinks of, it isn't discussed much. I mean, if you have these wind turbines, which are from a certain point of view great because they don't burn anything, but they do interfere with the flight patterns of migrant wildlife, and whether it's butterflies or birds and pollinating insects, who knows? And of course, you can say in terms of the other alternative forms of energy, it's not necessarily disadvantages, but just scarcities or difficulties of applying them fully. So, yeah, I mean, another if you look for generation of power from the tides, the kinds of device that have to be put in the sea and their interference with marine life, that all these things, what I'm saying is they at least need to be recognized, taken into account, note the limitations on the applicability of all these possible arrangements, so that at best, even with a very large-scale transformation in the way of generating energy, we still have to reduce the total throughput, the total amount of production, the total amount of energy required per person, let's say, for the continuation of social life.
Let's talk about a couple of sectors of the economy that you go into some depth in this book, Red Green Revolution, by my guest Victor Wallace, agriculture. So remind us how, first of all, how agriculture works under capitalism.
Well, the tendency under capitalism is to concentrate into larger and larger units and to be more and more specialized. By specializing crop production over large areas, you create disequilibria in the insect population. You generate pests, and you don't have the predators that would exist in a biodiverse setting. And so you introduce pesticides, various kinds of poisons. You deplete the soil. You over irrigate. You deplete the aquifers. So in the long term, the depletion of the soil, the depletion of the water, and the proliferation of pesticides or even of genetically modified crops, those have adverse consequences in a direct sense also for people's health. And I mean, a lot of these things are not fully understood yet, but the condition that people have, I mean, in terms of the increase in the incidence of obesity in the United States, partly from processed foods, but also certainly from the decline in the nutrient quality of what's grown, which does reflect the destruction of biodiversity and the concentration on specialized types of agriculture, and also, of course, in the meat industry and the way that the cattle and other livestock are raised, not as part of a natural cycle in which the fertilizer and the vegetation are all interacting, but instead concentrated in feedlots where tremendously polluting conditions and then fed artificially with hormones to increase their size and the rapidity of their growth. All these things are obviously unhealthy, and they're integral to the way in which capitalism develops. And they may sometimes be regulated by the government, but again, as I said, the government regulations can be stripped away by another party coming to power. So one needs to get back to a more integrated version and understanding of how agricultural production can be carried out that preserves the moisture in the soil, preserves the carbon in the soil, and even restores it where it's been lost.
And when we think of a socialist technology in the arena of agriculture, when we think of a socialist agriculture, is the main challenge the development of new technologies, in other words, innovation, or in doing something else?
Well, the innovation would come in the conversion to a different way of doing things, but some of the actual methods and understandings are age-old and have existed, you know, before the introduction of capitalist-type specialization. There may be new research done, for example, on the interrelation of insect species and predation and so on, and plus the fact that some of the traditional knowledge will have to be supplemented precisely because of the starting point, how to restore something that's been partially destroyed, you know, if it's still possible to restore part of it. This requires a level of research and indeed expertise, but the underlying ideas may involve readopting, reclaiming practices that are age-old, long-standing, and that have enabled certain communities, certain agricultural communities, to keep the fertility of the soil, to keep the soil itself, and not have the soil be the layer of soil becoming smaller and smaller all the time and the aquifers being depleted.
My guest is Victor Wallace. He teaches at the Berklee College of Music. He was for 20 years the managing editor of the journal Socialism and Democracy, and his book is Red-Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. It's published by Political Animal Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what steps, and you do this in your book, you try not only to envision or to suggest a vision of a socialist technology, but you try and point out where it already exists or where elements of it already exist. So what steps in the direction of socialist agriculture have been taken in which places around the globe?
Well, I wouldn't call it specifically socialist agriculture, but I would say it's a form of agricultural practice which, in order to recover, would require the rejection of capitalism. But actually, and ironically, under the pressure of necessity, they to some extent recovered it in Cuba when they lost the petroleum imports they had previously had from the Soviet Union and went back to a more organic form of agricultural production. And they also encouraged and incentivized urban gardens. That's an interesting type of development. I mean, to to some extent, this will happen spontaneously by people doing it on their own initiative in within an otherwise capitalist framework. But the point is that these things have to be done on a large scale in order to really have an impact. But other types of things would include neighborhood support, like, well, for example, in Venezuela under Hugo Chavez, they created local kitchens in the neighborhoods, local educational programs, local health clinics. These types of things, which sound, you know, very basic, there's nothing out of the ordinary about them in themselves, but they haven't been present for large sectors of the population under capitalism. And so it's something that, that is needed, that can be done on a small scale. Another example I mentioned of an attack on the traffic system is one that was carried out briefly in the city of Bologna in Italy during the period in the 1970s when they had a local communist government, and they had free public transit at rush hours, and they had a whole process of democratic discussion which resulted in the preservation of the center of the city for the people who lived there, not gentrifying them out of the area. So these are small steps, but that point in a positive direction, and they are associated with activating the population around the productive tasks that they regularly engage in and around the issues of the quality and nature of their neighborhoods. And I would say also that these are the types of things that can be initiated on a grassroots basis within communities on their own initiative. It's just that the obstacles to doing so are so great under capitalism that it's very difficult to have such initiatives. But cooperative types of initiative are important. They do take place and they do provide a basis for a way people can interact once the obstructions created by capital are no longer there. And another example, another type of example I allude to in this connection is the experience of worker control institutions, which have often proliferated very quickly and spontaneously in moments of revolutionary upheaval. And this is important to the general argument that I'm making, because one of the assumptions, so one of the hopes, let's say, one of the bases for hope that I have is that the very sense of urgency about the current situation will drive people into action at a higher level. And this is something that has arisen in other countries in moments of revolutionary upheaval, when suddenly people have a sense that they are no longer powerless, they can do things on their own. And one of the forms this takes is the creation of democratic institutions in the workplace, sometimes even without its being a revolution, but just a period of turmoil, like when there's an economic collapse, as there was in Argentina at the beginning of the 21st century, and a lot of businesses were failing, and workers took over the businesses and ran them themselves, entered into direct relations with the community. The workers themselves got more income. The community paid less because they eliminated the intermediary of corporate management. These are things that we see from such experiences that people are capable of doing. It's just that the conditions have to be stimulated to enable them, or let's say to leave the way open for them to do this on a large scale.
How important is it, in your opinion, for workers with different skill sets, say at an enterprise, to come together to discuss and share information in order to, you know, demystify what other people at other levels of the organization are doing?
I would say it's vital. One of the bases of capitalism is the idea, and this has been explored very well by Harry Braverman in a classic book of his 40 years ago, Labor and Monopoly Capital. But one of these foundational ideas is that there's a separation between conception and execution. All the conception, all the creative ideas are concentrated in the hands of management, and all that workers have to do is just implement them, just follow orders. And this is, let's say, the ideological expression of the class division in the society. And in order to bring out the creativity that's potentially present in everyone, this division has to be broken down. And workers, once they have an opportunity to do so, are eager to break through this type of division. They know how to do things often much better than those who are running the show. And in a way, this has been shown sometimes in labor actions, where when workers, one of their methods of demonstration is work to rule. in other words, do exactly as they're told to do and show that it doesn't work, that the only way it can really work is if they make the necessary corrections on their own, which are not anticipated by management. But once the workers have an understanding of what they are able to do, the possibility of deciding for themselves is a stimulus to be creative and to adapt to the real needs of the community.
Yeah, and this fits nicely with what you were saying earlier about how important it is to have democratic control over technology. You know, a lot of socialists, and I imagine a lot of eco-socialists, are very quick and eager with a lot of justification to point out capitalism's tendencies toward greed and rapaciousness. Is that enough in your opinion, or must radicals do something else to convince or persuade people that eco-socialism is the way to go?
Pointing to capitalism's greed and rapaciousness is part of the argument. The in a way, bigger argument is that our collective life as a species is in danger. And this hardly needs to be underlined now with all these incredible storms taking place and the latest report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So this is a product of the rapaciousness, but there's a tremendous urgency to combat and arrest and, if possible, to whatever extent possible, reverse these dangerous trends. So that's another aspect. But that also, in addition to that, there's the whole positive aspect of developing a more humane culture. And it's in this connection that I mention also in a section of my book about the indigenous communities, because their example is of value not only because they have built into their society a respect for the environment, but also because it's associated with a less antagonistic and competitive and aggressive attitude towards their fellow human beings. In other words, one has to have a positive image and not just a negative critique where there's rapacity and there's extreme danger, but there's also the possibility of a much more humane type of society.
Victor Wallace is his name. He's author of Red Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. Your argument for mass popular involvement in technological debate is a very compelling one. And it does mean, you know, if the conditions for this participation were actualized, it does mean that people would decide the fate of things that might affect them if they were developed. On the other hand, I mean, this is a tremendous task you're setting for us, right? That there has to be in place the kinds of institutions and the kind of education that would make people feel competent, that would give people competence in relation to technology. And that just seems so far away that this deference we have toward experts seems to inevitably continue such that elites and experts and those with expertise will continue to run the show, and people will be left behind and will be considered to be really only the consumer or the user of whatever device the elites decide to produce.
This is a real danger. I mean, but I think that what ultimately discredits these elites is the catastrophe that they've brought upon us. And this has to be recognized as a human-made catastrophe. And I think, for example, all these storms and forest fires and so on, they're called natural disasters, but the increased intensity, their increased incidence and their severity is a human-created product. And it's the product of precisely these elites. And so with all their expertise and all the refinements they can create and all the incredible ingenuity they can bring to certain tasks, they have created a destructive situation, which is bringing about disaster. So I think that the recognition of this disaster has to be tied in people's minds to the failure, in human terms, of precisely these elites. And this is the basis on which we can legitimately demand a new order of expertise or new basis for making decisions. The decisions that have been made on the basis of those experts who are at the service of these socially placed elites, this dominant social class, they have brought us to an absolutely catastrophic situation. And it's just a question of how quickly people will recognize it. I mean, I've been alarmed by this for many years, and my regret is that the general popular recognition of this situation has not been advancing at the same level as the destructive activities and the destructive tendencies have been evolving.
So you were saying earlier, Victor, that planning got a bad name on the left, partly because of the Soviet experience. And I'm wondering about, right, there's a suspicion of centralized planning of the economy, for example, among, well, not just people on the left, but many people on the left. When we think of eco-socialism and we think of socialist technology, how centralized or decentralized do planning and the planning and institutional mechanisms around technology in a socialist society, how centralized or decentralized should these be?
The discussion of what should be done needs to be carried on at every level, from the local to the national. In terms of the unit in which implementation can be carried out, that depends on what you're talking about, because there are certain types of service or activity that have to be planned over a large scale. I mean, if you're talking about, say, the transportation grid for a whole country, that can't be determined by local planning. On the other hand, the central planners have to refer to the local units of discussion to adapt the national network to the local conditions in any given situation. So it's a mixture of things. I mean, one of the obvious points that is always made about the environment, it doesn't recognize politically imposed boundaries. They're meaningless. So what one does in one place affects what's done elsewhere. The thing is that certain types of activity, like a lot of small-scale production, a lot of subsistence growth of food, these are things that whose arrangement can be and must be decided at the local level. And then the transportation grid for a large area has to be decided more centrally. I think the issue is not that one is opposed to the other. They have to act in a kind of complementary way to one another. Each has to draw on and be in consultation with the other.
Victor Wallis, W-A-L-L-I-S, longtime managing editor of the journal Socialism and Democracy. His new book is Red Green Revolution: The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. Victor, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, C.S. It's been a pleasure.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.